3CR Radiothon 2024. Sound on for solidarity.
Thanks for choosing a 3CR podcast. Throughout June, we're running our annual Radiothon, where we ask you, the listener, to make a donation so that we can continue to make great radio. Your donation will help keep us community-owned and community-controlled. Go to 3cr.org.au/donate, and with that done, please enjoy the podcast.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to late 30 a.m.
Only double. Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. Good morning, Leela.
Good morning, Priya.
How are you doing this morning?
Yeah, I am here. I'm awake. I'm feeling motivated.
Yeah, nice.
Surprising.
Well, look, you got to take the little wins, right? I feel like it's been an exciting week for radio. Yesterday, I taught day one of 3CR's podcasting course for the first time. Today's day two. Shout out to our wonderful students in this batch, and shout out to my wonderful co-trainer, Ayan, who is just extraordinary. Yeah, if people didn't know about that, 3CR does run podcast training. Head to 3cr.org.au to find out more about how to learn how to podcast here.
Yeah, it's great. We're empowering people to make more independent media.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is what we're all about, and one of the reasons why it's so important for us to be supported during Radiothon so our volunteers can keep providing these services.
Yeah, definitely. And if you do want to support during Radiothon, remember Radiothon for 3CR is running all across June. It's Sound On for Solidarity. We're trying to raise $275,000 by the end of the month to keep our station independent and on air for another year. So to donate, you can head to 3cr.org.au/donate, where there are options for you to donate over the phone. You can text in a pledge. You can also donate via our crowdraiser. And all of that information, again, is at 3cr.org.au/donate. And every donation over $2 is tax deductible. We're coming up to the end of financial year. Perhaps you have a wealthy benefactor in your life who would like to support independent media. They feel like mainstream media has really been crowding out the important conversations. Perhaps you can tune them on to 3CR Community Radio, and they'd like to put some of that money towards independent media that actually lifts up the voices of marginalized folks, that centers the concerns of First Nations peoples, like has robust political discussions about Indigenous sovereignty via incredible and longtime 3CR hosts like Uncle Robbie Thorpe, or that actually has a Palestine show, a dedicated Palestine show with Palestinian hosts, Palestine Remembered. Or maybe you want to direct people towards the excellent queer and trans programming that we have on 3CR, or the incredible community language programming. Where else are you going to hear Tamil language programming on radio in Melbourne? So there's just so many examples of why you should donate to Radiothon this year. Get us towards our target of $275,000. And also a reminder that you can nominate shows when you donate. And we'd love for you to nominate your favorite show, Thursday Breakfast, which you're listening to right now. So when you donate, you can say, I'd like this to go towards Thursday Breakfast target of the overall amount. It all goes into the same pot, but it does help us reach our individual show targets. So head to 3cr.org.au/donate.
Well said, Priya.
Thank you.
Maybe
we'll go into our rundown for today.
Yeah. Speaking of independent media, we've got some great interviews lined up today. And first of all, we're going to hear from Sophie Emder. So on Monday, the Victorian government announced their proposal for updating the state's minimum rental standards to make homes healthier, more affordable and more energy efficient. And while there are some promising changes, There are also some major gaps, and to help us better understand these amendments to rental standards, we're going to be joined by Sophie, who is the senior community campaigner from Sweltering Cities, a health NGO that works directly with people in hot suburbs and homes to campaign for more livable, equitable and sustainable cities. And if you'd like to have your say on minimum rental standards in Victoria, you can actually attend a workshop with Sweltering Cities this month to contribute to a submission that they're making to the Residential Tenancies and Residential Tenancies Amendment Regulations in 2024 before it's finalised by the Vic government. And after that, we'll be hearing from Kate Fitzgibbon, who is an international research leader in the area of domestic and family violence, femicide, responses to all forms of violence against women and children, perpetrator interventions and the impacts of policy and practice reform in Australia and internationally. And today, Kate is joining us to discuss some new research examining the merits and limits of domestic violence disclosure schemes, also known as DVDS, in so-called Australia and Aotearoa.
Amazing. And after that, we're going to hear an interview that I did earlier this week with MJ, who works at Sisters Inside and is a member of the National Network of Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. And MJ joined me to speak about unequal access to the National Disability Insurance Scheme, or NDIS, for people in custody and on remand. Now, while it can be extremely challenging for people who've not already been granted access to funding under the scheme to complete an application in custody, MJ also explains the barriers that people inside face when it comes to accessing already approved NDIS-funded supports. MJ is a formerly incarcerated Aotearoa woman committed to ending the criminalization of women and girls. And finally, we're joined by Te Raukura O'Connell Rapira, who is a Maori and Irish political organizer, and they are the lead claimant, or one of the lead claimants, in the urgent Waitangi Tribunal inquiry into the New Zealand government's erosion of Maori representation in local government via an attack on the Maori ward system, which they're going to be speaking with us about today.
Yep, and now we're going to go into a quick CSA before bringing you the headlines for today.
How do you feel when you donate to the 3CR Radiothon? I feel good.
Get a warm inner glow by donating to the 3CR Radiothon.
It's like giving money to the family.
It makes me feel good.
All right.
It feels like I'm playing a part in the economy, which usually I don't do.
How does it make me feel? Well, it gives me a great feeling of satisfaction.
Great. Might go to heaven.
Great.
Good.
3CR Radiothon through the month of June.
We need your support to keep radical voices and issues on the airwaves.
There is no other radio station like it.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au.
Call the station on 03 9419 8377.
Or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy during business hours.
3CR. Hey! Sound on for solidarity.
Have you heard about 3CR's national programs? Coming at you on community radio stations around Australia. Produced in the studios of 3CR Melbourne.
Services will be cut, jobs may well be lost, and workers' entitlements will be undermined.
Their basic human rights are as important as everyone else.
Over 200 million years, individual species have evolved. I mean, birds were once dinosaurs.
Anything nasty online seems to be targeted against women.
Muckety is a bad deal, but muckety is absolutely not a done deal.
You're listening to Women on the Line.
Welcome again to Lost in Science.
And welcome to another edition of The Radioactive Show.
You've been listening to Earth Matters on the Community Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to Accent of Women.
It's Annika Swall this week.
You are listening to Let the Bands Play.
Tune in to Stick Together, worker stories and union news. Grassroots Voices broadcast weekly on the Community Radio Network.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 6th of June. More than 120 bodies of Palestinians were recovered this week from the rubble of Jabalia camp in Gaza after Israeli occupation forces left the area decimated during their brutal 20-day attack on the supposed refugee safe zone. In central Gaza, medical staff say that morgues are overflowing and hospitals are struggling to cope with the surge of casualties from Israel's latest attacks. In Naam in the past week, thousands of pro-Palestinian protesters brought the city to a halt by shutting down a major intersection, recreating the wreckage of a bomb site. This followed a national day of action against Labour MPs last Friday, with activists continuing calls for government to end the production and export of weapons to Israel and to impose sanctions on Israel and expel the Israeli ambassador.
In other news, with a warning for First Nations listeners that this headline contains mention of a First Nations person who has died. The coronial inquest into the police shooting of Walpri and Lurcha teenager Kumanjaya Walker has concluded. The Northern Territory Police Commissioner gave the final evidence, conceding that he has gaslighted members of First Nations communities when denying that there is any racism in the police. Zachary Rolfe, the police officer who shot and killed Mr. Walker, ended his final involvement in the inquest by declaring that he was bored by the protests and admitted that he has never been held to account for his racist behaviour and his lack of preparation and risk assessment that could have prevented Mr. Walker's death. Mr. Walker's family, who have withstood the pain of the inquest for more than 2 years, are calling for divestment from prisons and policing and the reinstatement of community control, as well as an end to excessive use of force and discriminatory policing in Yuendumu. Samara Fernandez-Brown, a cousin of Mr. Walker, said, quote, "Our families and communities have stood strong, showing up every step of the way for truth and justice and for my cousin Kumanjaya. Racism killed Kumanjaya. Racism from the police, the government, from Zachary Rolfe. Yet none of them have ever been held to account for Kumanjaya's death," end quote.
Also in headlines, reports this week indicate only 43% of Centrelink claims were processed on time in the first 4 months of this year, and only 10% of youth allowance apprentice payments are processed on time. Disability support pension claims had the longest claim time, taking an average of 107 days to be processed. The Services Australia report notes Centrelink agrees to process claims within an agreed timeliness standard, but currently well over 75% of claims fall outside this period.
And finally, in headlines, activists from West Papua have held traditional ceremonies outside Indonesia's Supreme Court in Jakarta, calling for their lands and forests to be protected from palm oil plantations. Representatives from Indigenous Aiwu and Moi communities rallied as the court was reviewing an appeal to revoke permits for four palm oil companies whose proposed plantations threaten their customary forests. The appeals challenged plans such as those by a Malaysian-owned palm oil company to clear tens of thousands of hectares of previously untouched West Papuan forest. The Supreme Court is the community's last chance to defend more than 65,000 hectares of rainforest, including their customary forests and generations of ancestral heritage and political control. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 6th of June. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
We're talking about ecological thinning and subsidised logging, but we basically mean the same things, don't we, here?
Wherever there are chemical corporations around the world, they're constantly trying to chip away at regulations.
Earth Matters, bringing you environmental and social justice stories, from developments in government and industry to the campaigns and communities that are standing up to them. Earth Matters plays at 11 a.m. Sunday and 6:30 a.m. Wednesday. Turn your dial to 855 a.m. or listen online at 3cr.org.au.
While the headlines have subsided, the nuclear power plant is still not under control, with the spent fuel rods removed from only one out of four reactors.
Law needs to change so that our rights can be recognised, so that decisions in relation to the use and exploitation of our lands is out.
Slavery is back.
Welcome to a place where private business profit from a captive labour force, yet pennies are spent on medical services to a population in which the Indigenous, the poor and the mentally ill are overrepresented. Where isolation, humiliation and degradation are facts of life. Welcome to prison.
depends who's telling the story, I suppose. The prisoners would have one view. The people who work in the prison system would have another. And I think it's up to people to decide where the truth is.
Give government propaganda and the media spin doctors the flick. And check out Do and Time for news, views and tunes on prison issues from Guantanamo Bay to Christmas Island to prisons and detention centres everywhere. Every Monday at 4 p.m. on your community radio, 3CR.
We are still fired up and we're still talking about revolution.
And we're back on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And we thought we'd ease you into the show this morning with a track. This one is a classic by Alice Skye, Party Tricks.
Your intentions are clear when we spoke. My feelings for you are a joke. So why has my brain done this again? I placed your validation over my friend's life.
And we are back on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. That was Party Tricks by Alice Skye. Such a beautiful song. I love Alice Skye's music. I'm so glad that we have gotten the chance to play so much of Alice's tracks and so much more amazing First Nations artists across Thursday Breakfast over the years. And speaking of being able to listen to incredible First Nations, but also Australia-wide talent on community radio, that's one of the amazing benefits of listening to 3CR community radio, whether you're listening on air, whether you're listening via the radio or whether you're streaming online. We're trying to bring you local talent, local music, and also incredible local political, environmental, cultural conversations.
That's right. And folks, next week, you can be the talent.
You can be the talent. This is your chance for only a small fee to be the talent on Thursday Breakfast.
That's right. If you make a donation of $2 or more, it's not only tax deductible, but you have a chance to be shouted out on air by us, or even call or text in and have your own 30 seconds to 1 minute of fame.
Yeah, that's right. You just have to make sure that when you do donate, you nominate Thursday Breakfast so we know to shout you out in particular, to let you know you are the OG of donating to Thursday Breakfast. We will say that to everyone. Everyone is the OG. Everyone who donates. But you, yeah, might actually get the chance to be on air. If you do text in or call in during the week to make a donation, you say you want it to go to Thursday Breakfast, and you say that you are comfortable to be called to talk about why you love breakfast radio, just let the operator know. Let whoever picks up know, and they can make a record of it, and we can be ready to call you during next week's show.
Yeah, so on the day, Priya, if someone hasn't set that up, can they just call the studio on the landline?
They sure can. So next week, for all of the breakfast shows, and including Thursday Breakfast, what we're going to do is we will have a lovely assistant, one of our amazing volunteers, who's going to be helping out by taking calls from people who would like to donate during our showtime. So that's between 7 and 8:30 a.m. Usually our phone opens at 9 a.m. with the office, but our phone lines will be open for all of the live shows that are going to air. So if you call between 7 and 8:30 a.m. on 94198377, that is 94198377, next week, you can call, make a pledge, and then if you're interested, we can take you to air, have a quick little chat. You can tell us about why you love community radio. And if you stay on the line afterwards, we can then take down donation details and add you to our count.
Yeah, that's right. And if you want to donate directly to the Breakfast Show Fund, you can go to givenow.com.au/CR/3CR Breakfast 2024. And that'll take you, yeah, directly to the fundraiser for the breakfast shows, and you can just note that you'd like to pledge to Thursday Breakfast.
Yeah.
And then we'll know how good we are.
Yes, we will know how great we are, because it's not a competition, but it's kind of a competition. Even though the money all goes to the same place, some of us are rabidly competitive about Radiothon.
The leftists are looking for an excuse to be competitive, because
exactly,
we're so focused on
we're fighting
communal
amongst
care.
Ourselves, you know, classic leftist infighting. Who can raise the most money for 3CR? Honestly, I feel like that's a worthy cause. You know, trying to compete to raise the most possible money to keep independent community media on air for another year. Our goal is $275,000. So really, if you want to keep fueling this fight, you should really just chip in for our show and multiple other shows. Really.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, keep the competition strong, you know?
I know.
Make it hard to get.
And also, there are heaps of other ways to donate. So if you prefer donating in cash during the time that our station is open, so that's 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday, you can also head to 3cr.org.au/donate to then find out how you can donate cash, donate by check, call in and send in your bank details to donate that way, text in a pledge, donate online. There's so many different options. All of those, again, collected on 3cr.org.au/donate. Sound on for solidarity with 3CR in 2024. Remember, you're only going to be able to hear these incredible interviews that we do with on-the-ground activists, the recordings that we get from rallies, you know, the incredible political insights we get from First Nations activists here and further afield on 3CR.
Yep, and we're going to be back with our first interview for today after the CSA.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous. The people of Gaza, who have survived ethnic cleansing, three wars and a 16-year siege, are now facing the biggest attacks ever mounted against them.
This will only stop if governments like ours demand that it stop. Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
You are what you eat, and you are what you eat.
Local Food Connections interviews with food producers, backyard growers and urban farmers. Join us every Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on 3CR Community Radio 855 on your AM dial, on 3CR Digital Radio and live streaming on 3cr.org.au/streaming. Local Food Connections, a show about the importance of local food in sustainable communities.
From dust to dust, you gotta just trust that upper crust, then maintain that good terrain from whence you came.
On Monday, the Victorian government announced their proposals for updating the state's minimum rental standards to make homes healthier, more affordable, and more energy efficient. Whilst there are some promising changes, such as mandatory cooling, weather seals, and better insulation, there are also some major gaps, and to help us better understand these amendments to rental standards, we're joined by Sophie Emder, Senior Community Campaigner with Sweltering Cities, a health NGO that works directly with people in hot suburbs and homes to campaign for more livable, equitable and sustainable cities. If you'd like to have your say on minimum rental standards in Victoria, you can attend a community workshop with Sweltering Cities this month to make a submission on the Residential Tenancies and Residential Tenancies Amendment Regulations 2024 before it's finalised at the beginning of July by the Vic government. Good morning, Sophie. How are you?
Morning. I'm doing well, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us bright and early. First of all, I thought you could start by giving us some background on Sweltering Cities and the work they've been doing more recently around heating and cooling and rentals, yeah, to improve standards in Victoria.
Yeah, absolutely. So Sweltering Cities, so we're a health organisation, a national health NGO that works primarily in Melbourne. And we work directly with communities and people that live in hot suburbs, not homes. And we look at how we can increase people's resilience to heat and what we can do to reduce heat illness and also heat death in our community, because we know that heat is a really serious issue. And because of this, for over a year, we've been talking and working with renters all across Victoria that live in hot homes to win cooler and more affordable homes that people can live safely in. And we don't think, you know, it's an unreasonable ask that everyone has a safe home that doesn't make them sick for 3 months of the year when it gets really hot. And we started this campaign specifically because we know, and if you're a renter yourself, and I'm a renter, so, you know, this is something that a lot of us can relate to, that renters are being forced to live in dangerously hot homes during summer, which is making people sick, basically. And in Victoria, like across the country, our homes really aren't doing the bare minimum, which is providing people safe shelter. So yeah. Since the beginning of last year, we've been meeting with renters to hear what they want to see specifically to make their homes cooler and safer during summer. We've been collecting stories from renters about their experiences. We spoke at the Victoria Rental Crisis Inquiry 6 months ago, and we've tried to share and spotlight renters' stories in the media. And now with this announcement about these, you know, exciting proposed new standards, we're mobilising renters to make, you know, to make as many submissions as possible to the government's consultation so that as many renters' voices are heard throughout this process so we get the best possible outcome.
Yeah, thank you. It's really important work that is urgent, really. It's a bit hard to imagine hot weather right now, but it's also, you know, when you think back to how hot this past summer was, it was a dangerous summer, and it's only going to get worse. So, this can't wait until we hit those hot days. We have to be organising now as to how to protect people living in rentals, during these hot times. So what are the proposed changes to minimum rental standards, and how do they compare to what is currently in place in Victoria?
Yeah, so in terms of the government has said they're going to do a few main things to make homes safer and cooler in summer. So those three things they've said they'll do. Number one, they've said that all rental properties will have to have a fixed cooling system in the main living area and air conditioning. And number two, all rental properties will have draft ceiling. So that basically involves sealing up all the weather seals on all external doors in the house. And number three, all rental properties will have to have ceiling insulation installed where there is no insulation already. I think the most important thing to say on this is that this is, firstly, a really positive step that a lot of renters are feeling, you know, excited by the fact that cooling is going to be included in the standards. But what I will say is that the bar is really low, right? Because currently we have no mention of cooling anywhere in our rental minimum standards. So currently our rental rules in Victoria, but nationally as well, see cooling and, you know, living in a house that doesn't turn into a sauna for 3 months of the year, that's a luxury for people, not something that people have the right to. So, you know, the government has currently rental homes have to have a heater for winter, but these same rules don't apply to cooling. So there are really no standards right now that help renters to advocate for even like common sense cooling measures like blinds, window coverings, things like this. We're excited that cooling is being included in the standards and insulation. That's really, really positive and exciting. But something, you know, what we think and what we've heard from renters that we've spoken to is that the government in these proposed new standards, they've missed something really important, which, like I just said, is those common sense energy efficiency measures that we've had hundreds of renters telling us that they want to see. Things like blinds, curtains, screen doors, window coverings, really, you know, simple things that would make a massive difference to not only people's health, but also their wallets and how much they have to spend on keeping their homes cool during summer. And I just thought of one of the stories, one of the renters that we've heard from recently. And she's rented in Victoria for 25 years and is part of the growing cohort of people that's renting for longer or renting for life. And she has asked her landlord many, many times, my house gets really hot. Can you put in a fan? Can you put in blinds? Can you put in screen doors? And again, she's been refused. So we want to see a change to the minimum standards where these cheap and simple cooling measures are made accessible to people, because we know that putting them into standards is the only proven way to actually protect people who are living in dangerously hot homes and to give them the power, any type of power, to actually be able to get those changes enforced.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that things like blinds are crucial for energy efficiency, and they are a really basic you don't have to build any new infrastructure. They're mass produced, and all in all, if you're an investor or a property developer, this is not a big cost for you, but for renters, it can be really expensive to invest in new blinds or energy efficient blinds for a rental that, you know, you don't know if you're going to get evicted in the next 6 months. You don't want to be investing all of this, but at the same time, you have to be able to live well in your rental and be safe and cool in your home. So that's a really good point. And I think we had a bit of a chat about how a lot of people don't actually know that it's not an obligation for landlords and agents to provide fly screens, which is like we live in quite a damp environment, and in summer there is a lot of mosquitoes and flies and bugs. And me personally, also as a renter, that I mean, there have been debates in our household about the benefit of being eaten alive by mosquitoes or being boiling hot with the windows closed, which, you know, the bar is low.
Yeah, the bar is extremely low. And I remember speaking to a renter in Melbourne, and she was saying that so she has all these windows in her house that are broken, so she'll open them and there's no fly screen. But even when she opens the window, it just drops back down, so she can't even keep it open anyway.
Yeah.
And that's been fixed by her landlord. So then no airflow is getting through the house. And, you know, these might seem like small things, but if you're immunocompromised, if you're an older renter, if you have a disability or a medical condition that puts you at high risk for heat-related illness, you know, not having windows that can open, not having fly screens, not having, you know, having drafty floorboards, which means that your air conditioning is too expensive to run, these can be serious, you know, extremely serious medical life or death issues for some people. So we really need to be taking them extremely seriously. And that's what we want to see taken more seriously in the standards as we move forward in the consultation.
Yeah, absolutely. And access is a huge part of this. So I think it's really great that hopefully we can have contributions from community members that fall at, you know, intersections of disadvantage. We can hear their voices a bit more and their needs. You know, people living with disabilities in rentals is a whole, I think it's really underrepresented in these conversations in general. So that will be really good if we can get some of those contributions to hopefully help the Victorian government make relevant amendments to minimum rental standards. Now, we've gone over some of the gaps that we'd like to see addressed. I was also, this was brought to my attention by you talking about some of the conversations you've had, and we're in a housing crisis and rent is steadily rising across the board. It's been rising for the last 2 or 3 years, and it's still going up on a yearly to monthly basis, depending on your lease. Could landlords pass on the cost of these changes to renters? And do you have any comments about how we would manage that as a community or as an advocacy organisation?
Yeah, this is really, really important. And the cost of living crisis is something that we see when we talk to renters, especially when it comes to the cost of people cooling their houses. But I'll answer your question first. What I would say is that the reality is, you know, if you're poor and you're a renter, you're more likely to live in a really badly built house without proper insulation, without proper cooling, and you're more likely to die during a heat wave. So, you know, the cost of living crisis, it doesn't mean we should be backing off pushing for energy efficiency and these, these measures. It means that we should be leaning in. So we want to see health be at the heart of every one of these rental standards and every policy when it comes to renting. But we're also taking our guidance from not only renters when it comes to the messaging on this, but also organisations working specifically to advocate for stronger rental protections, rent caps and things like that. So we're taking our guidance from them, but we're saying that the core message is that health needs to be put into our rental standards, because the consequences are way too high for them not to be, from what we've heard from hundreds and hundreds of renters.
Yeah, and on the topic of most vulnerable renters, will these changes apply to public housing or is it just private property? Private renters.
So from what we can see, these changes will apply to all renters in all tenancy types, so including private renters and renters in social housing, so public and community housing. But this is something that there hasn't been a lot of messaging on. Like when you look at the media coverage around the new standards, there hasn't been that much talk about how these changes will apply to people in public and community housing. So we really need to make sure that we're pushing for these changes to apply to everyone, because I think sometimes when people think of renters, you know, as a collective conversation, people think of private renters and not those living in public and community housing. And we've had lots of conversations with people living in public housing, particularly older tenants living in high-rise public housing across Melbourne, who have disabilities, have medical issues that make it, you know, this is an extremely serious issue for tenants living in older tenants living in public housing that don't have any cooling in their homes, and that promise of air conditioning that has just been delayed and delayed by the government. And we really need to be pushing for these standards to apply to everyone and in the same time frame as well.
Yeah. We need clear follow through with these amendments.
Exactly.
And yeah, on the community input is so essential in the fight for better standards. To finish up, could you explain how people in the community of renters, people outside of the community of renters that care about rental standards, maybe, how can they make their voices heard before the Vic government finalises these amendments?
I would say the consultation is for everyone. And if everyone in Victoria made a submission to the consultation, I just can't imagine what impact that would make, an absolutely massive impact. So if you're a renter, if you have family or friends that rent, or, you know, you just simply care about making sure everyone has a safe home to live in, which I would assume is most people, then we really encourage everyone to make a submission and make sure that your voice is heard. And there are two main ways that people can make a submission. So number one, people can make a submission directly to the Victorian government on their consultation website. So they've given people two ways to do this. And number one, there's a really simple survey that people can fill in and answer a couple of questions. Or they also give you an option to upload a written submission and upload it directly to the website. And the second way people can make a submission is they can add their comments directly to the Sweltering City submission that we're making, specifically around cooling and insulation. So to do this, people can follow us on social media. So our Instagram and Facebook are Sweltering Cities, and we are posting about the consultation there and how people can get involved. Or people can email me directly with their comments if they'd like to, and I'm more than happy we can add them to our submission directly. We can provide details for people of all of the ways that they can make a submission, but there's lots of ways that you can do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much, Sophie. And we'll also include some of those links on our podcast, and we will keep listeners updated about where those workshops will be held if you want to contribute to Sweltering City's submission. If you want some help doing that, if you live in a hot rental but don't quite have the stamina to make an independent submission, I think it sounds like you'll have a really strong submission at Sweltering Cities with that community input. So that's really great to hear that you're facilitating that process actively. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Sophie. Have a great day.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. Bye.
Have a great day. Bye.
So we just heard from Sophie Emder, Senior Community Campaigner with Sweltering Cities, which is a health NGO that works directly with people in hot suburbs and homes to campaign for more livable, equitable and sustainable cities. And keep an ear out for more information on those workshops that Sweltering Cities are running to make a submission to the Vic government about its amendments to minimum rental standards. You're listening to 3CR 855 AM. It's just hit 7:45 and we'll be back with you in a minute.
Have you heard of long COVID? If you or someone you know have had COVID-19, you may still experience symptoms weeks or months later. There are many symptoms of long COVID, but the most frequent are extreme tiredness, shortness of breath, and muscle aches and joint pains. Anyone can experience long COVID, including children. You can find information in your language on the Health Translations website, healthtranslations.vic.gov.au. Just type long COVID as a keyword.
A 3CR supporter.
Western Sahara, along the Atlantic coast of Africa, is the continent's last colony, a land of struggle and resilience. Join Mohamed Mayara, a journalist, activist, and trade unionist from occupied Western Sahara, on his June tour. Events include a dinner and an art exhibition on June 10 at the Lomond Hotel, a panel discussion on June 12 at the Trades Hall, and a documentary screening and a discussion on June 13 at the Institute of Postcolonial Studies. For more information, visit Australian Western Sahara Association at awsa.org.au or email us at info@awsa.org.au.
A 3CR supporter.
Kate Fitzgibbon is an international research leader in the area of domestic and family violence. Femicide, responses to all forms of violence against women and children, perpetrator interventions, and the impacts of policy and practice reform in Australia and internationally. And today, Kate is joining us to discuss a new research examining the merits and limits of domestic violence disclosure schemes, aka DVDS, in so-called Australia and Aotearoa. Good morning, Kate. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so we've got a lot to unpack. We don't have much time, but this might lead on to another conversation if we don't get to it all. So I thought, first of all, we could go over the practical implications of domestic violence reporting schemes. And then I'm also interested into delving into the systemic issues that contribute to domestic violence a little bit and the factors that impact an individual's capacity to access safety and support. And I also just wanted to give a disclaimer that, yeah, we will be mentioning domestic violence, intimate partner violence, and family violence. So if that's of concern to you as a listener, you might want to tune out for the next 10 minutes. And if you are needing support right now, you can call 13YARN on 139276, YARNing Safe and Strong on 1-800-959-563, and those are First Nations support lines, or you can call Lifeline on 131114. Okay, so let's get into, first of all, what is a DVDS, Kate, and what are the reasons that a person can be listed on one?
So a domestic violence disclosure scheme, currently in Australia we only have one in South Australia, and it's based on the idea of right to know and right to ask. So the idea that for an individual that has concerns in their relationship, there should be a scheme that they can call up and find out whether their partner has a history of domestic abuse or other abusive behaviours. So it works to provide information to someone so they can make informed choices about their safety and about their risk in a relationship.
Yeah, thank you for that. So first and foremost, this was mentioned in your research as well. The implementation of this scheme assumes that victim survivors need and want this type of information. It also assumes that users of the service are willing to engage with the criminal justice system, such as going to the police. Based on your research, does this assumption accurately reflect the needs of people at risk?
Yeah, absolutely. So we found that a lot of the assumptions and objectives of the scheme weren't actually being realised in practice. So in speaking with a small number of people who had accessed the scheme either in South Australia or in Aotearoa, we found there was a few different things between the objectives and what was happening in practice. One was that for the majority of applicants that we spoke with, they were actually accessing the scheme after they had already left the relationship and after they had already experienced abuse. So they weren't accessing the scheme to make decisions in a current relationship or to find out if they were at risk of abuse. They were more accessing the scheme to confirm the suspicions that they already had and the experiences that they had already had. And so that's quite different in terms of how the scheme was intended. We also found that it was taking quite a significant amount of time for individuals to get that information. And this was what was concerning for us in terms of whether those people were at risk. They need timely support. Yep. But from the time that individuals would call up the scheme and request a disclosure, it could take up to 3 months, we found, for them to receive that information. And of course, it's really important then that the information they receive is reliable. And what we know about all forms of domestic, family and sexual violence is that they are heavily underreported for a range of different reasons, that victims may not be willing or able to engage the police. So there is also a concern as to whether the information being provided is accurate and does actually allow people to make accurate decisions and accurately understand their risk in a relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really, really important point. And on the topic of representation and accuracy, another notable concern that was raised in your paper was the potential for some groups of people to be veiled in the system as a result of wealth or privilege, leading to underrepresentation of people with systemic advantage and a potential overrepresentation of disadvantaged communities on these registers. So I wanted to ask you, what is the risk of increased visibility and criminalisation for First Nations people and culturally and linguistically diverse communities on a domestic violence disclosure scheme?
Yeah, this is such an important point. We know that our First Nations communities and other marginalised communities are heavily overrepresented at all points of the criminal justice system in terms of policing, courts and in our prison statistics horrifically. We also know that for misidentification, where victim survivors are misidentified as the person using violence and may receive a police record as part of that, we also suspect that First Nations and marginalised people are also overrepresented there. So a scheme such as this has really important and concerning implications for First Nations communities that may be overcaptured on a scheme like this, but also might be misrepresented as a perpetrator on a scheme such as this.
That really, you're really touching on my next question. So to quote your research, we know that misidentification may be occurring in up to 50% of cases where women victim survivors engaged with the legal system present to domestic violence services. And due to, you know, our systemic racism that we have here in so-called Australia, First Nations women are at particular risk. What is being done about misidentification currently? Is it being addressed? And yeah, what's the potential for a DVDS to exacerbate this issue if it's not currently being addressed?
It's a really important issue. We've definitely got increasing awareness and data on misidentification in Australia, which is an important step forward from, you know, only 5-10 years ago when really nobody was talking about this. So there's certainly increasing awareness, particularly in practice, where, you know, particularly our women's legal services are seeing this as a reality on a day-to-day basis. We have seen increased training and practice attempts through specialist training and education to drive down misidentification in police. But this is absolutely something that we need to pay greater attention to. The impacts of misidentification are significant, both in the short term and the long term. So it's really imperative that that we try and reduce misidentification and eliminate it altogether.
Yeah. And on the topic of police response, we have a reliance on response-based services to domestic violence, such as police intervention, which is really, you know, treating the... It's responding to something that's already underway. And response-based services have been criticised as they largely fail to address or it can even compound underlying systemic issues that put people at risk of experience violence or make someone more likely to perpetrate violence. Can you comment on the need for foundational early interventions such as access to housing, alcohol and drug services and financial assistance?
Early interventions are absolutely critical. Ultimately, police should not be our go-to. We do not want situations of domestic, family and sexual violence to get to a point where police intervention is required. We should be absolutely focusing on early intervention and ultimately prevention, trying to eliminate these acts of violence altogether. We know that in Australia, family violence is the leading cause of women's homelessness. That is a horrific reality, that for far too many victim survivors across the country, they are choosing between staying with an abusive partner or experiencing homelessness and living in poverty. What we need to ensure is that we have the early intervention and the support services in place to support safety for victim survivors that want to leave an abusive relationship or have concerns in their relationship before they've experienced abuse. That means supporting financial independence. It means empowering victim survivors to make choices and to be supported in those choices. And then absolutely critically, for victim survivors that have experienced abuse, it means supporting their recovery and healing, because we want those individuals to go on to thrive after their experience of abuse.
Yeah, yeah, we are really looking at long-term supports here and absolutely not short-term reactions. So I think maybe to wrap up now, we could talk about this so much longer. It's a huge topic. But, you know, this paper on the Domestic Violence Disclosure Scheme, I think, highlighted some really important issues that we should be addressing before implementing something like a Domestic Violence Disclosure Scheme. So one of the gaps that I noticed that was also noted by you is the lack of research around certain groups. So how do we develop services to support groups that are underrepresented in research, such as disabled people and the LGBTQIA plus community, if we don't have adequate information about their needs?
This is really important. When we're developing services, interventions, prevention initiatives, it's really important that we engage with community in co-production and co-design. We need to ensure that we're not making assumptions on behalf of communities about what their needs are and what their wants are in terms of at all points of the system, prevention, early intervention, response and recovery. So we need to be developing the relationships. We need to be empowering those communities to make the choices that are right for them and ensuring that the services and supports put in place best meet their needs.
Yeah, and do you think there will be research hopefully leading to policy changes to address those gaps in research for disabled people and the LGBTQIA plus community?
Absolutely. There's, you know, some wonderful research underway across Australia working with those communities. And so it's really important that we are elevating that and that there is resourcing for that work. It can be time intensive. It needs to be community engaged and community led. So really ensuring that support is there, and then that we have policymakers listening to what the recommendations and outcomes of that research is, so that we can build the very best suite of responses. There's no one single policy or reform that will meet the needs of all victim survivors, because they are such a diverse and varied group with wide-ranging experiences. So it's really important that our suite of responses reflects that.
Yeah, and hopefully these policy changes can be informed by a lived and living experience from victim survivors.
That's so critical.
Yeah. Kate, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing about that research. Yeah,
thank you so much for having me. Thank you. Bye.
So we just heard from Kate Fitzgibbon, who is an international research leader in the area of domestic and family violence. And we did touch on some heavy topics there. So if you need support, you can call our National Domestic Violence Hotline, 1-800-RESPECT, which is 1-800-737-732. And you can also reach out to Lifeline on 131114 or to a First Nations only support line, 13YARN on 139276. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. You're on 3CR 855 AM.
And now we're going to go to our next interview. And this is a conversation that I had earlier this week with MJ, who works at Sisters Inside and is a member of the National Network of Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. And MJ joined me to speak about unequal access to the National Disability Insurance Scheme for people in custody and on remand. MJ is a formerly incarcerated Aita woman committed to ending the criminalization of women and girls. MJ, thanks so much for speaking with me today. Can we start off by hearing a little bit about the National Network and its role in centering the voices and wisdom of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women in so-called Australia?
I guess before I begin answering that, I just would like to acknowledge the Yuggera and Turrbal people, who are the traditional owners of the land where I reside here in Meanjin, and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. Our network in Australia was founded in 2020 by Debbie Kilroy of Sisters Inside. We are an organisation that is comprised of cis women, trans women, gender diverse people and girls who are currently or formerly incarcerated across so-called Australia. Our mission is to end the incarceration and exile, surveillance and punishment of women and girls by opposing the intersecting gendered, racial and class violence that sustain in the prisons and police. We are committed to Indigenous sovereignty, which requires the abolition of the prison industrial complex, and believe that only women and girls who have experienced incarceration should determine the terms of freeing all women and girls in cages. I mean, you know, we have members in every state and territory of Australia and are entirely led by people with lived prison experience. So our membership includes individuals who have been in nearly every single women's prison in the country, as well as those that experience, you know, in the community correctional orders, home detention, bail, police custody, parole. So I guess our knowledge is not just theoretical, but relational and lived, making us, I guess, the ultimate experts in carceral oppressions in Australia.
So we're here to talk about a really specific aspect of that, and that is, I guess, the disability justice question or disability injustice, and particularly in relation to the National Disability Insurance Scheme. So listeners might not necessarily be familiar with what it means to try and access the NDIS in prison, and a bit of, you know, this buck passing that occurs between the federal government, which runs the NDIS, and then state and territory governments, where their justice departments are supposed to be handling the day-to-day care of people who are inside or on remand. Can you tell us a bit about this?
Okay, so I guess, you know, like, while the federal and state government pass responsibility back and forth, there are individuals with disability who require these essential services and are neglected and harmed due to the lack of the support that they're getting. These services are important for the well-being in prison, but also their ability to reintegrate safely back into community upon release. Yeah, like people convicted with an offence or in prison are still part of our community and deserve that equal access to NDIS support. individuals with disability, like particularly intellectual disability and acquired brain injuries, they're significantly overrepresented in the prison system. Now, like one in four First Nations individuals in custody have an intellectual disability. And in addition to this, like there's research that indicates that First Nation women in prison have higher rates of cognitive, physical, and psychosocial disability. And in terms of the federal government, like they oversee the NDIS, the state and territory governments, they manage the prison system. So this division, I believe, of responsibility leads to the gaps in the service provisions, because both sides at times deflect their responsibility and resulting in a lack of accountability for ensuring that continuity of care. But in theory, the NDIS is supposed to be there to provide support to eligible individuals regardless of their circumstances. However, in practice, a person with a disability enters the prison system and their access to NDIS support is just significantly disrupted.
Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to try and access, you know, plan management in the NDIS, reviews of people's plans for people who are inside or on remand? I understand that there are justice liaison officers and justice planning teams who are supposed to be involved in this kind of care. So what do they do?
Okay, so I guess in discussing the NDIS and its core mission of providing equitable support to individuals with disabilities, irrespective of their circumstances. Now, however, I guess I want to highlight a concerning contradiction in how this support is administered within, you know, correctional services nationwide and the broader legal system. So we have the Justice Liaison Officers, who is under the NDIS. They're tasked with bridging the gap between the NDIS and the legal system to ensure that continuous support for individuals with disability during custody. Now, running concurrently with that is this newly established justice planning team, and they offer specialized assistance beyond NDIS standard pathways. So catering to those with complex needs and has had multiple incarcerations or extended custody periods. Now, this is the, I guess, to access this, even if you are already an eligible participant and an approved participant, there are still eligibility requirements. Like an example is you have to have had multiple incarcerations over the past 5 years. You like currently incarcerated and have been for more than 12 months. Participants under guardianship. Multiple incarcerations within 12 months period in a youth justice setting. So I guess this raises a critical concern. Why are individuals who are already eligible for ongoing NDIS support in custody, they encounter additional barriers to access their entitled services? The criteria for specialized support appear to contradict the inclusive principles of the NDIS and the rights of individuals with disability to receive that consistent care. The justice liaison officers are supposedly there to assist participants who are approved. They are currently approved. So not the ones trying to access it, but our current approved participants, and are the same for the new justice planning team. So they're not there to help assist an individual in filling in the access forms if they are found eligible whilst in prison.
It seems like then there's this extra eligibility criteria that they then have to go through for people who are already a part of the scheme to access this support. Is that?
That's correct. So, you know, in terms of when we were talking about remand, now, majority of individuals are remanded, they'll be released before that 12-month period. But because they haven't been there for 12 months, they haven't been seen by by the justice planning team to either review their plans prior to being released or to review their plans whilst they're in a close setting, as they call it, like to make sure they have that continuity of care. So there's a lot of individuals that miss out on this because they don't meet that criteria. Like, why do they need to go through that when they're already approved and they need that care?
Yeah, so they've already met the threshold criteria to be a part of the NDIS scheme, to access the scheme. But then because of all these other arbitrary criteria, like having to be there for more than 12 months, they then don't access the support services to actually execute the plan.
That's right. And, you know, and like they're already exceptionally vulnerable, you know, so they encounter these significant hurdles whilst they're waiting to access essential services, which can increase their conditions, you know, in some situation, like during imprisonment. Like, it's a factor that is sadly linked to deaths in custody. And yet there hasn't been any improvement. There has been these placements of these new teams, but it's still not meeting what people with disability in prison require. They're still being missed. There are still gaps. We as organizations that go into the prisons, we can't even access these. They're under the corrective services. So we can't access and say, hey, we have this woman, we need you to see them.
Yeah, and not to mention what we spoke about before about the fact that there are so many people with disabilities that go into prison that have not completed an NDIS application or might have completed one in the past and been knocked back, told that they're not eligible, that they don't have the right paperwork. And so there are people that have fallen through the gaps of the system itself. And then there are people that are being pushed through the gaps when they actually do have access to an NDIS plan, when they've been approved for the scheme. But because of the way that the plans are administered for people that are interfacing with the carceral system.
Yes, that's right. And I guess, you know, the NDIS, like it's designed to, or it's supposed to be designed to provide this vital support for these individuals. You know, they must uphold their principles consistently across all settings, including within the legal system. I guess addressing these contradictions and streamlining these processes is important to ensure that every person, regardless of their legal status, receives the necessary support to live safely and independently. I mean, you know, this effort not only aligns, I guess, with the core values of the NDIS standards practice, but I guess it also underscores our commitment to fairness and justice for all.
Definitely. Now, I know that the National Network has an upcoming meeting with Bill Shorten, who's the minister for the NDIS. What changes would you like to see? And you've touched on a couple regarding NDIS access, but also access to being able to execute their NDIS plans for people who are in custody and on remand.
I'd love to talk to him about, you know, get rid of these further eligibility criteria for individuals for a start. Like, why do we need to do that? I also, you know, believe that an external organisation is needed to liaise or link with the local area coordinators that is in the community to be able to fill in the access request forms for eligible participants in prison. Like, you know, the process at the moment is, you know, they see prison mental health services, and then they'll say, yes, they're eligible. But from there, they then get referred to the transitional coordinators who can assist. So that whole process at times can take up to 6 to 7 months because of the huge delay in accessing these services already. So having an external organization to assist with that, because when you look at the NDIS guidelines, you know, there is a criteria there that whilst a person is in a correctional setting, you can request for a priority decision for a person prior to them being released for their application to be like fast tracked. I mean, if this was utilized a lot more, this would make a huge difference in making sure that individuals are properly supported upon their release. And that is not, I've yet to see that be used. And I think the individuals also need to have somebody to advocate for them when creating their plan. Their plan is so important. You know, that establishes the type of supports that they need. How are they supposed to articulate all that and what they need? So they end up with this plan, and yes, NDIS has given them lots and lots of money. It can't use it. It's not the right plan.
MJ, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really appreciate it, and we will make sure to share some more information about the National Network with our listeners in our show notes.
Thank you so much for having me, Priya. And I just want to say, if anyone wants to read more about what we do, visit our website, thenationalnetwork.com.au.
And that was MJ, who's a formerly incarcerated Aito woman committed to ending the criminalization of women and girls, and who works at Sisters Inside and is a member of the National Network of Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls, who joined me earlier this week to speak about unequal access to the National Disability Insurance Scheme, or NDIS, for people in custody and on remand. And again, while it can be incredibly challenging for people who've not already been granted access to funding under the scheme to complete an application in custody, MJ also explained the barriers that people inside face when it comes to accessing already approved NDIS-funded supports. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
We know you love listening to 3CR, but we also know that many of you haven't downloaded the Community Radio Plus app yet.
The app lets you tune in anywhere and share the station with your friends.
So, show the love and share the love and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
They're pulling on the boots in Brazil and wiping off the eggshells in Moorabbin. Fascism's on the march, and we say, yeah, nah.
Yen Up Asaran is a new weekly program on 3CR dedicated to tracking this rise in Australia, Aotearoa, and all around our increasingly warm little globe.
Every Thursday at 4:30 p.m, we'll be talking to writers and fighters about some angry blighters.
We're talking about ecological thinning and subsidised logging, but we basically mean the same things, don't we, here?
Wherever there are chemical corporations around the world, they're constantly trying to chip away at regulations.
Earth Matters, bringing you environmental and social justice stories from developments in government and industry to the campaigns and communities that are standing up to them. Earth Matters plays at 11 a.m. Sunday and 6:30 a.m. Wednesday. Turn your dial to 855 a.m. or listen online at 3cr.org.au.
While the headlines have subsided, the nuclear power plant is still not under control, with the spent fuel rods removed from only one out of four reactors.
Law needs to change so that our rights can be recognised, so that decisions in relation to the use and exploitation of our lands is ours.
And you're back on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. This is just another reminder to you that this month, June 2024, is Radiothon for 3CR. That's right, Sound On for Solidarity. Where else are you going to hear some of the most incredible current affairs and local interviews with artists, Australian musicians, with people that are going to be sharing basically political views and cultural products that are not available on mainstream media, that mainstream media doesn't really want you to hear? Where else are you going to hear the nation's only Palestine dedicated Palestinian show with Palestine Remembered on 3CR? So to donate to our goal of $275,000 to keep the station independent and running for another year, you can head to 3cr.org.au/donate. There's plenty of information there about different ways that you can donate. And all donations over $2 are tax deductible. Make sure to nominate your favorite show, Thursday Breakfast. When you do donate, it'll go towards our own little target as part of that broader $275K. But once again, that's 3cr.org.au/donate to get in for Radiothon 2024.
How do you feel when you donate to the 3CR Radiothon? I feel good.
Get a warm inner glow by donating to the 3CR Radiothon.
It's like giving money to the family.
It makes me feel good.
All right.
It feels like I'm playing a part in the economy, which usually I don't do.
How does it make me feel? Well, it gives me a great feeling of satisfaction.
Great. Might go to heaven.
Great.
Good.
3CR Radiothon through the month of June.
We need your support to keep radical voices and issues on the airwaves.
There is no other radio station like it.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au.
Call the station on 03 9419 8377.
Or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy during business hours.
3CR. Hey!
Sound on for solidarity.
And we're back for our final interview of today. And we're joined by Te Raukura O'Connell Rapira, who is a Maori and Irish political organizer and one of the lead claimants in the urgent Waitangi Tribunal inquiry into the New Zealand government's erosion of Maori representation in local government via an attack on the Maori ward system, which they'll be telling us about today. Good morning, Te Raukura.
Morning.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us and have a quick chat about the very serious issue that we're seeing with the New Zealand government's attempts to basically get rid of Maori wards. I mean, of course, what they're talking about is taking every single ward to a referendum for a vote. But in an ongoing settler colonial occupation, of course, the power dynamics involved mean that this puts the wards really at risk. So could you tell our listeners briefly what the wards are and what the attack from the government has been?
Yeah, sure. I think very quickly, I think it's important to place it in a historical context, which is that, of course, Māori have sovereign rights, laws, practices that precede the arrival of the British Crown. And that was affirmed through what's called He Whakaputanga, which is a declaration of independence that was signed by Māori chiefs in 1835 and then recognised by the King of the British Crown at the time. And then that was later affirmed in what is known as Te Tiriti o Waitangi, which is the founding document that allows for the British Crown to govern its own subjects on Māori land, which is what the Māori version of the treaty says. And so we invited the British Crown to govern its own subjects because basically their subjects on our lands, their people on our lands weren't listening to us and our laws. And so that's kind of the history of this. But of course, that promise has been broken multiple times by the British Crown, and they, as you mentioned, are occupying Māori lands and not upholding their part of the agreement. And so for, 184 years, Māori has been just like, Aboriginal people here in Te Whenua Mui Moia, the land of the dreaming, we have been exercising multiple tactics, multiple strategies to try and have our sovereignty and our mana motuhake, which is a kind of localised iwi decision-making, recognised. And Māori wards is one of the latest ways that Māori have strategised to have that recognised. And so basically what they are is they're seats in the local councils that guarantee Māori representation. And so in the same way that people would elect a local councillor to local government, Māori have to run in an election for one of these Māori seats to represent that particular area, but in particular to represent Māori interests in that particular area. And so rather than their accountabilities being towards the general public, their accountabilities are towards Māori tribes, our lands and our nations. And so since historically, Māori wards have been very hard to set up because they were subject to a referendum, which could be initiated by 5% of the population in any area, saying we oppose these Māori seats being set up. And what has been happening for the last kind of 20 years is that right-wing lobby groups have been funding and organising to get that 5%, because it's not a huge number, and forcing polls to happen. And then as a result of that, Māori wards don't get established. And so I was part of a campaign in 2018 and 2019 where we worked to change the law that allowed for those referenda to happen in the first place. And we were successful in that effort. And as a result, Aotearoa has gone from having just three councils with Māori wards to 49 councils that either have them now or will have them at the next local elections. And so that's like a 1,500% increase in Māori representation and represents 58% of local decision-making authorities. And so that's been a huge amount of progress in a short amount of time towards genuinely honouring te tiriti o Waitangi. Mm. And I would say that this new government feels threatened by that and wants to take us back to colonial times. And so now what they're doing is trying to reinstate the ability for those referenda to happen. And so what we could end up with is, 48 mini the voices across Aotearoa, which is obviously going to be divisive, racist, and just horrible for everyone involved.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, of course, given the way that this impacts Te Tiriti, the Waitangi Tribunal has conducted an urgent inquiry into the Māori wards and constituencies. And on 17 May, they found that the government's legislative attempts to remove Māori wards is in breach of the Treaty of Waitangi. So what were some of the key concerns from the tribunal and how has the government responded?
Some of the key concerns that we raised were that we know from when polls like this have happened historically that it creates the conditions for bullying, hatred, violence. We collected a bunch of stories as part of the claim from Māori and from non-Māori, where the polls created the conditions in which people were spat on in public for supporting Māori wards. People received death threats who worked in councils, who were trying to bring about Māori representation. And so it just creates, the social conditions in which violence is more possible and more likely. So that was one of the primary concerns. But the other one was that the government is continuing to erode Māori abilities to make decisions about what happens to our whānau, our families, our communities, but also our whenua, our lands. And so what the Waitangi Tribunal found was that whole communities have benefited because of the improved and strengthened relationships that have come about as a result of having Māori in councils. It's actually just a really practical mechanism for good governance and good partnership. And to give you a tangible example of that, Aotearoa has been subject to lots of cyclones and floods over the past couple of years. And when these extreme weather events that have come about through climate damage, which of course is driven by the extraction of Indigenous lands, It's marae. It's our meeting houses. Mm. It's local nations who open up our meeting houses to host people, to feed people, to volunteer, to keep people safe. And it's often Māori wards councillors who are playing a role between organising between council and their resources and Māori and our resources in order to keep everyone safe on our lands. And so one of the primary concerns that we were raising in the tribunal is that by removing Māori wards, we remove an ability for Māori to look after the people on our lands. And this is what I wish more people understood, is that we are responsible not just to our lands, but also to every single person who lives on our lands to make sure that they are well, that their spirit is well, that their physical well-being is well. That is our sacred responsibility. And too often, colonizer governments don't recognize that that's actually what we're trying to do.
Absolutely. It really is it's that ability to practically exercise political power, even if it's, in relation to a colonial system, to receive or to enact tangible outcomes for people to be able to control resources, to be accountable to their communities. And this is, seriously under threat with the government's push to introduce a bill to effectively reintroduce that requirement to put the existence of these wards up to referendums. Now, we're going to have to wrap quite shortly, but can you let us know about what's next in the fight to save Māori wards, considering the government has put forward a bill after the Waitangi Tribunal Inquiry's report came out saying that getting rid of the wards or any push to get rid of the wards would be in violation of Te Tiriti?
What's been incredible is that there are democratic processes that governments have to follow, even when they're trying to push through their own political agendas and ride roughshod over their own supposed rules of democracy. So they basically opened this process for less than a week, where members of the public could make submissions on their proposal to reinstate these referenda. And within a matter of days, more than 8,000 people have made submissions, and the vast majority of those are in favour of what we are saying, which is please protect Māori wards so that Māori can be involved in decision-making that affects our people and our lands. And I've been sitting in on the oral submissions, and I actually made my oral submission this morning to the Select Committee. And what's been incredible is that the vast majority of those submissions are actually coming from non-Māori. Two out of every three mayors in Aotearoa are in opposition to this government's proposal. And so it's their own people, their own leadership, who are saying, actually, this is not okay. And so what's been really wonderful is that despite the fact that the British Crown or the New Zealand Parliament is failing to uphold their relationship with Māori, everyday people, our treaty partners, tangata tiriti, people in Aotearoa by virtue of the treaty, are actually acting in right relationship with Māori and standing up and saying, no, enough is enough. We have to do better than this. And that has been commendable. And my hope is that energy continues beyond this political moment.
Amazing. Look, Te Raukura, thank you so much for taking us through this. We'll have more information in our show notes, and hopefully we'll get to chat with you again about this soon.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical independent bookseller and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs in the basement of Trades Hall in Victoria Street, Carlton, or check them out at nibs.org.au to find more information about upcoming discussions and events.
3CR Radiothon 2024. Sound on for solidarity.
You've been listening to a podcast produced at 3CR Community Radio. It's Radiothon time. This year, we need to raise $275,000 to keep the station going. Any amount you can afford makes a big difference. It's so easy to donate. Head to 3cr.org.au/donate. We rely on the community's support. Thanks for listening.